Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we examine converging systemic failures in economy, ecology, and human coexistence on Earth. Rather than despair of these crises, we see them as related symptoms of a larger system that doesn't work, and which we can choose to replace. In that spirit, we search for concrete solutions, transformative visions, and ways to get there together. We look at hard realities with you on this show, remembering that big crises are also big opportunities we can act on together, building community resilience as we go. We believe that facing the facts and our deepest fears can paradoxically unearth our fondest wishes and best collaborative creative nature. Won't you become a paradigm warrior? Join us in envisioning and building a radically better future on today's edition of Post Carbon Radio. I'm your host, Kara Nyhus, this week with my co-host, Bing Gong, in the studio. Our program today is an interview with activist, academic, and author of Ideas for Action, Cynthia Kaufman. Cynthia Kaufman is a professor of philosophy at De Anza College in Cupertino, the director of the Institute for Civic and Community Engagement, and most recently is the author of Getting Past Capitalism. In today's wide-ranging discussion, we cover capitalism, the climate crisis, and the relationship between these two failing systems. We talk about how we got here and how to get out of our predicament. Join us today for a conversation with Cynthia Kaufman. Let's start, as you do in your books, talking about how you became an activist in the first place and how that turned you into a critic of capitalism.
So I grew up in suburban Southern California and was somebody who thought the world had to be more interesting than it seemed in the suburbs, but I was not particularly connected to anything political. My parents were not political people at all. Actually, my story is a little strange. Most people got involved in activism because of somebody they knew. I literally read an article in the LA Weekly about what was happening in El Salvador, thought it was terrible, reminded me of the Vietnam War, which I had been too young to be involved in protesting, but, you know, thought I would have or could have, or, you know, I had missed something big by missing the 60s. And when I read about that, I thought, wow, that's something really terrible that the U.S. government is supporting a dictatorship with it, which at the time seemed surprising to me. Now I know that it's incredibly common. I just made a phone call to the organization that the article was about and then got involved with CISPIS, which is the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, and did work on that, kind of opposing U.S. dictatorships in Central America for about 10 years. And I was a college dropout at the time and didn't have a sense that there was much that I needed to know about the world because nothing in school seemed very interesting. And then when I got involved in politics, I realized, like, oh, actually, this really interesting people have been wondering about these problems of the world and have written a lot of great things about it, and that there's this whole great conversation. So I ended up going back to college and then continuing on to grad school just because I kept wanting to study more.
Part of what I like is that you write, your intention is clearly for this work to be used by regular mm-hmm. people who are trying to make change in the world. So you use simple language mm-hmm. and short sentences and examples that we can all relate to.
Explain every reference.
Explain every reference. You don't shy away from using terminology mm-hmm. like enclosure when it's necessary and mm-hmm. it's a kind of term that you're going to need to talk to other people mm-hmm. who understand that, and it encapsulates a great amount of a whole period or a whole phenomenon in one word. So I just want to thank you for doing that. And what it also reminds me of is that in terms of activism, I think right now one of the things many of us suffer from is doing actions because we feel good without being really clear and intentional about what we're actually trying to achieve and whether mm-hmm. our activism is going to forward that goal or not.
Yeah.
We do things because we know how to do them, whether it's a creative action or a street demonstration, mm-hmm. without really having a goal, you know, strategy and tactics discussion.
Yeah.
And I think there's something similar about that in the academic world, that people are trained to write in a certain style. They know that it'll give them prestige.
That's right. And I think if you're going to try to change the world, you have to be strategic. And that for so long, I think people felt fairly hopeless about their attempts to change the world. And so they were more coming out of a sense of moralism, expression, just this is what I feel like doing right now, and actually weren't strategically oriented at all. And
because we didn't think we could win.
Exactly.
So we'll just do something to show that we weren't doing nothing.
Exactly. Just the rage against the machine, you know.
And for you as an academic, or as you said, you're a part-time academic, does it put you in a place of discomfort in your context to write something that's intended for use by regular people
You said you worked very hard and you were very deliberate to write in this clear and plain style.
Yeah.
Did that bring you out of your comfort zone? Does it bring you out of your reward zone with colleagues?
You know, it's a really interesting issue. And I feel like I made a decision really early on to be an organic intellectual. You know, that's a concept from Antonio Gramsci, who's one of my favorite philosophers, a Marxist from the early 20th century. And his whole thing was that, you know, that ideas are a really big, important part of politics. And then you have to look at the political context in which ideas happen. And so I think that academia is a place that has really sucked up leftist intellectuals and neutralized them. And there's a way that people's sort of sense of status and success all comes from other people in academia. And frankly, when I was in graduate school, I went to graduate school after being radicalized. And I was like, okay, I want to be a social change activist. That's my goal. That's what my life is about. And I really enjoyed graduate school and I learned a lot. But I really saw the academic rat race that took place there. And so I was sort of never really a big part of that. Like, I always knew that. I mean, actually, frankly, when I went to graduate school, people told me I would never get a job. And I was like, that's okay. You know, I'll have a PhD and that will be fun and interesting and I can do it without going into debt. And then I'll go and be a school teacher and I'll be an activist on the side. And so that was my life plan. And then I thought, well, but if I could get a job and if I could get a job as a community college teacher, that would be really great. So for me, I had always known that I was taking kind of an in-between and a really different path.
You used Gramsci's term, the organic intellectual, and you are that in the sense that you are an activist as well, right?
Right. Yeah, no, that's really true. And so, but still, I feel like a lot of times when I'm doing activism, the people that I'm working with aren't necessarily reading my work. You know, I think there were other periods where the people who wrote work for movements were important parts of those movements, and people in the movement all would be reading and all would be talking about those ideas. I think we're in a period where there's less reflection, where people sort of do what they think they need to be doing without necessarily, without a lot of sort of step back, reflect, let's be strategic, let's understand why we're doing what we're doing. And that's something that I actually think we're entering a period where that's starting to maybe get better. I think that there's more of a sense of optimism that maybe we can make a significant difference, that the world is starting to go through. You know, people use this word, the great turning, which I really like. You know, this idea that maybe we're in the middle of a really massive shift, which I know we'll get to climate change later, but I think with climate change stuff, there is a sense that the world can't continue as it's been. Something has to change, and it will change. Maybe for the better, maybe for the worse, but the future will not be much like the past. I would say 20, 30 years from now, the world will be very different, the social world. So I think people are starting to feel that. And in fact, some of my students came back from some of the protests against police violence saying that they were feeling really overwhelmed, the sense that things were growing and moving so quickly that they almost didn't even know how to get a handle on it. That was exciting, but it was also sort of frightening. And I have a sense that we're entering a period where social change stuff is going to start to accelerate, and people are going to start to dive in more deeply and read more.
You got into being an activist. You combine it with your academic work. You've been writing about this for a while. What brought you into climate as an issue?
So I have always been somewhat, you know, I've been a broad-based in social justice activist, so interested in lots of issues, and I've always been somewhat interested in environmentalism, though also for many years frustrated with the kind of narrow focus on just kind of conservation of the purity of nature that you sometimes see in environmental politics. And then I read George Monbiot's book, Heat, and that really helped me a lot, because there were years when I thought, this climate thing seems to be a serious problem. And I think maybe I don't want to really think about it because it seems unsolvable. And what Monbiot's book did for me was basically what he argues in that book is it's really not that hard. You know, the point that he makes is that we already, and this book came out maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it's even more true today than it was when he wrote that book, that we don't need to change the way we live very much to be completely sustainable with respect to the climate. And that was really shocking to me. And made me see, like, oh, this isn't a technical problem. It isn't sort of an invention of science problem. It's really mostly a political problem. And I know about political problems, and I know how to deal with them. Because if you think of climate as something that we're all doing every day because of when we turn our heater on or get in our car, then that's pretty hard to understand how to change it. But if you see climate as a problem that there's certain big practices that need to change, like where we get our fuel from, And but we don't need to stop living in houses. We don't need to stop being warm and comfy and cozy in our houses. We don't need to stop moving around quite a bit. We need better systems of public transportation. We need more efficient ways of having stores so that you don't have all the lights all the time. There's a few changes like that that we need to make, and they're all technically within reach. And the only reason we aren't making them is because the fossil fuel companies are subsidized, are putting out lies with respect to climate denial, and the way they control our political system. Once I understood that that was the problem, it then became something that I was really excited about being part of changing. And I was sort of bumping around trying to find a way to be involved until I found the divestment movement. And that, for me, has been just amazing because...
Fossil fuel divestment.
Right. Because there are people who are working to divest from fossil fuels as a way of stigmatizing the fossil fuel companies, as a way of undermining their political power. And for, to me, that makes total sense as a strategy. So I think what kept me from getting involved in climate change activism was a sense, not having a sense of a way forward. And now that I have a way forward, I'm really excited about it.
And how did you specifically get to ask questions about capitalism?
Oh, so the capitalism part. You know, I think as I started to learn about why was the U.S. supporting the dictatorship in Central America, you know, that just seemed like such an odd thing to do. And the more I read about it, the more I came to understand that it was part of this larger piece that had to do with global capitalism and imperialism and like that. And so I came to realize that the reason that the U.S. supported the dictatorship was because the dictatorship was on the side of capital and people with money and keeping people poor there, and that the people who wanted were making a revolution were trying to change that situation. It was actually really obvious, you know. And I have to say that one of the things that I have thought about capitalism is that it's really obvious. And yet we're all told we're not supposed to talk about it or look at it. It has been the elephant in the room for a long time.
It really is that crass.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Not just obvious, but also crass. We're really just doing this for the money.
Yeah, we really are murdering people all over the world so that some people can make a ton of money. Like, you got to be kidding.
And it's not new. It's not a mistake. It's kind of the
story
of the history of European imperialism, right?
Yeah.
And you go into that in your book. You really trace capitalism. So let's go there. Let's talk about what is capitalism and how did it start out?
One of the things I think is important to think about the origins of capitalism is to think about it as related to slavery and colonialism. When I first started reading about this, there's sort of debates within the literature about that. And one of the things that I think is important is to bring race and gender into the analysis of capitalism and to understand how these different things kind of fit together. And so I think that there's a lot of different ways you can go all the way back. You know, you think, you know, go back to like the 12, 1300s, there was a whole sort of transnational trading regime that was based in the Muslim world. And some people date capitalism to then. I think, though, that capitalism then comes to become something really different than just the sort of those forms of trade that existed in the Muslim world when you get mercantilism. And so you have the British and the Dutch having governments. Actually, let's go back to Ferdinand and Isabella. You know, 1492, the Spanish government wants to have an adventure and get rich. And Columbus sells them this idea, like, wouldn't it be cool if you sent me up a ship and I went and did this thing, right? So these early mercantile adventures. So,
and let's just say, because you do in your book, that mercantilism was when the royals invested, right?
Exactly.
The monarchies invested.
Yeah.
To make money.
Right, exactly. And so, and it was not for any particular survival need. I think it was, you know, my sense of it is that it was largely just a possibility to get richer, you know, and glory and all that sort of thing. So, you know, Columbus comes to the Americas, not in India, no spices, can't be part of that whole transnational Muslim trade world, so let's try something different. And then begins, you know, right away begins the slave trade. And so then you have slavery and colonialism happening at the same time. As that starts to emerge, then all this riches are coming back to Europe, and there's nothing to do with them, mm-hmm. because part of the feudal economy is that everything is sort of based on tradition. And so you've got these sort of, you know, like in England, the sort of, you know, the younger sons of aristocracy who aren't going to inherit the big estate, who have nothing much to do, and so let's go on mercantilist adventures and bring some glory and money back. But then there's nothing to do with that money because there's no system of investment in Europe. And so then you end up with the enclosures where people like John Locke, importantly, start advocating for let's take land which officially belongs to the monarchy, but in fact is used by common people just to raise crops and hunt animals and gather firewood and things like that. Let's enclose that common land, raise sheep in it, and then use that to sort of as the beginnings of industry. So you have just the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution taking place with the capital that comes from mercantile slave and colonial situation going on in the Americas. So all those pieces kind of come together.
So one of the things I just want to add in, because you do talk about this in your books, is that enclosure is this huge, important turning point in Western history, right?
Yeah.
Because even though the people were peasants, maybe, living under a monarchy, in another sense, they were independent, right? Mm-hmm. That they had this organic life that they controlled, where they went out and grew stuff and grazed their animals and kind of made their own clothes and food, right? And
right.
Pretty much lived according to their own time scale and
that's
ambition
right.
and...
Yeah, no,
and
thank
that
you
was
for
all gone.
That's a really important part to bring in, because that was a when you think about the English Revolution, that it was kind of a three-way revolution. You know, people often talk about like, oh, there was the backwards monarchy and the forwards looking sort of capitalists, and there was a war between those two people. But there was a third force in the English Civil War, which was the commoners, who were fighting to kind of keep that lifestyle that they had had. And sometimes when people think about sort of feudal Europe, they sort of imagine everybody as serfs, and it's not true. Most people were living not fabulous lives of wealth or anything like that, but really autonomous lives where they were largely working within sort of small rural communities, mostly dependent upon themselves. And I think that's a really important part of what happened with capitalism was the enclosure of the commons. And so people talk about dispossession as one of the main ways that capitalism creates wealth. In other words, it's not just that capitalism is so brilliant and it creates wealth. It actually takes wealth from the commons and turns it private. So that's, I think, a really important concept in the critique of capitalism is the idea of the enclosure of the commons. So if you take back to that sort of original story that I told you, that where you've got land which people had kind of eked out perfectly decent, you know, minimal existence on, being enclosed in order to have profit making sheep farming and early industrialism with textiles, that process happens over and over all over the world. So you think about the Ogoni people in Nigeria who were living as, you know, indigenous people on the land, having their land taken away by Shell Oil, you know, with the help of the Nigerian government and the United States government. That's a situation where their common land was enclosed for private gain. And that's something that's happening, that's a big part of the struggle with capitalism still now. And it's one of the ways people talk about the climate, is if you think about it, the atmosphere is a commons. It's something that we all share, that we all rely on. We have different ways of figuring out who gets to use it in different ways, and governments sort of regulate pollution. And then all of a sudden you have this thing where we've realized that the commons is in danger, and we don't have any kind of a mechanism for protecting that thing which belongs to all of us. And it's being used as basically a garbage dump for the fossil fuel industry.
So that's a way in which understanding the past helps us think about strategies for the present, right?
Exactly. No, that's really right. And so that we can understand what's happening, I would say going back all the way to what you had said a while ago about when you realized that the wars in Central America were not just a mistake. It's like if you think that people just don't like, oh my gosh, I didn't know we were on the wrong side. Like, then the answer would be education, right? But if you understand that actually the people who know it full well know what they're doing, and they're doing it on purpose because it actually serves their needs and interests, then that's a whole different situation. Then you have to educate people to mobilize pressure and change the situation. So I think the whole point of doing social theory is to understand the deeper dynamics of a political situation so that you can then come up with strategies that are actually going to work.
I want to go back to dispossession and primitive accumulation.
Uh-huh.
These are terms that come out of Marxist theory,
uh-huh.
but they're not very complicated. Like you said,
yeah.
dispossession is really just stealing stuff.
Yeah.
And primitive accumulation, the way I learned it was that it was kind of like a linear view of history, where uh-huh. primitive accumulation was how capitalism got its startup capital.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that stuff was enclosed, it was privatized, it was taken from the people, essentially.
Yeah.
But then they got rolling, and then, you know, capitalism went through its cycles of investment and booms and busts and all the things it does,
right.
Primitive accumulation is always going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why, actually, I don't use that word primitive accumulation. And there's just a couple little things about that. So one is, like, the word primitive has a whole sort of racist history.
Yes.
And by the way, that's a bad translation for Marx. And ursprüngliche, mm-hmm. So it's like original accumulation.
Mm.
But also, it implies, like you said, that was how it all got started. And actually, that was a big part of Marx's theory. And I think that more contemporary critics of capitalism are realizing, like, how much, I call it enclosure, mm-hmm. how much enclosure is an ongoing process and actually a very significant part of the profit that happens with capitalism. So, you know, certain amounts of profit happen because, like, oh, I came up with a better machine and everybody loves my machine. You know, so Apple is just insanely rich, you know, partly because they're good at dodging taxes and partly because they're good at exploiting, you know, super exploiting Chinese labor, but partly because they have really good designers and they come up with machines that people really like.
Yeah, so there's some virtue in there.
Right, that's right. And there's some sort of, like, this kind of classic idea that capitalism creates wealth by fostering innovation, invention, and kind of more clever and quick ways of doing things. That is part of where wealth comes from in capitalism, but a huge amount of it also comes from the Marxist concept of exploitation, is when you pay people less than the value that they produce, right? So that's a huge part of where wealth comes from capitalism, is just by keeping wages low. And then the other thing is this thing about accumulation by dispossession, also known as enclosure.
And let's name some modern forms of that to make people familiar. I mean, I think of dispossession by the mortgage crisis. People lost their homes,
right.
And then the values plummeted, and
right.
those who had money, like hedge funds, were
right.
able to snap them up.
Or look at the internet. I mean, the internet is an interesting case where we're just in the middle of this struggle, where it started out with government research, you know, and so whenever people say, like, oh, but you need capitalism because you needed the innovation that comes from, you know, people trying to get rich off of things. True, the kind of sleekness of design you get with Apple products, that's a capitalist thing. But the sort of basic infrastructure and deeply new ways of doing things, like the internet, that was government-funded research. So that's a government-funded research, and it's kind of government institutions that got it going, and it's something that's been this amazing public good that's been for everybody. And now there's a fight over the enclosure of the internet. So the whole thing, that the fight that's happening right now over net neutrality, the point of that is, can companies make it so that they can kind of control access of the internet, such that I get to the internet through Comcast? Because I got in through Comcast, only things that give money to Comcast will I be able to kind of get well. And so that's an enclosure of a commons. Also, think about water. You know, and people say that water is going to be the next oil, in the sense that it's going to be the next resource that we really fight over. And, you know, right now in this country, in most places, tap water is cleaner than the stuff you get out of plastic bottles. But people have somehow been taught to believe that the stuff that comes out of plastic bottles is safer, better, cooler, more convenient, whatever it is that they think it is. And so I think that's another enclosure. So that's sort of like a psychological enclosure. And then there's real enclosure of water. Like, there's a huge struggle in Cochabamba, Bolivia, where the government decided to sell the water company to a conglomeration of private corporations that then raised the price of water tremendously so that people couldn't afford it. That's an enclosure.
And that was Bechtel, our local San Francisco corporation.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
And the people kicked them out.
And it was a wonderful struggle and led to the emergence of a left-wing government in Bolivia. And that has made some real differences there. So those are some examples. And also the sort of the patenting of seeds, you know, so and intellectual property. Those are all things where, you know, turmeric is something that you know, people in India developed and used for thousands of years, that then some corporation has tried to patent and make it so that they own the concept of turmeric, or, like, you know, parts of our bodies and things like that, you know, sort of genetic information. So that sort of fight for enclosure of the commons is it's a huge part of what's happening in our world right now.
So a very valuable concept for us to know about and apply.
Exactly.
I want to add to what you said about how we talk about corporations as if capitalist corporations are where innovation comes from solely.
Yeah.
And you talk about government research and investment, research and development, and, you know, at the beginning phases where the basic research is done, something like 90% of the experiments fail, and
uh-huh.
our tax dollars pay for that expensive
right.
part. So And that's true in the National Institutes of Health. Mm-hmm. It's increasingly true in universities, right? Where the biotech research is the basic science is being done there. And so those costs for the 90% failure rate are absorbed by taxpayers through tax dollars at government institutions, including universities. And then when something that works comes out of it, whether it's the internet or biotech, then it's profitable. And then the private companies get it and they don't absorb that cost.
Yeah, that's right. Right. And that's bad enough. And then you have these private companies investing in universities and then sort of owning that research. So, there's a case of Tyrone Hayes, this fabulous biologist at Berkeley, who did research that showed that atrazine was bad for frogs and caused sexual mutation. And Novartis, the company that funded the research, basically wouldn't let him publish the research. And then he did the research again under with another funder, and they've been harassing him. Mm-hmm. But Novartis has this very powerful relationship with UC Berkeley, where, by the way, only 10% of the funding for the university comes from the state. So there's this also sort of privatization of public goods. And I would say that that's another enclosure of a commons. If you think about a school like UC Berkeley that used to be completely funded by the state and a tiny bit from tuition, actually it used to be not funded from tuition at all. Increasingly it's being funded from tuition and also funded by private corporations. So that public good has been enclosed and taken over by private corporations.
And in that case, this argument that capitalism can do it more efficiently, well, it's not more efficient or cost-effective from the student's point of view if they used to pay almost nothing to get a free university paid for by the state, and now they have to pay upwards of $10,000 a year as if it were a private university.
Right.
And
yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think that the idea of capitalism being efficient is a mistake in all kinds of ways. So we've just covered a couple of them. So one is that research and innovation, a lot of the important stuff is paid for by government, is subsidized. The other thing is efficient for what? My favorite thing to hate is Apple, right? So it's just a good example for lots of things. Apple has done a really good job making these machines that some people really love. But what social problems have they solved, right? So if you want to say, what's the best way to solve the problem of malaria? That's a really serious problem. Lots and lots of people die of malaria. Capitalism hasn't solved the problem of malaria because the people with malaria aren't rich. So capitalism does a good job at efficiently finding very, very clever ways of doing things that get people to spend money. But if you step back and say, but what are the best ways to do the things that make people happy? That's a whole nother situation. And so if one thing that makes people happy is curing diseases, capitalism, sometimes you can use capitalist mechanisms to cure the diseases that impact the rich, but not always. Right? And so I just think you have to, that question of efficiency, you have to step back and say efficient for what? I have a big section in the book, too, on happiness, and I think that's a really important concept where, I had always believed that money doesn't make you happy, and that was not my life path, and I know lots of people who've taken a life path of no, let's pursue the things that actually are interesting and give us security, but also make life interesting. In more recent years, there's been a whole body of social science research that has proven it empirically, which makes me really happy, that just asked people thousands of times in thousands of different ways all over the world, how happy are you with life, your life? And they've done lots and lots of different correlations, and it comes up very consistently that if you live in a stratified society, the rich people tend to be happier than the poorer people. But if you live in a less stratified society, everybody's happier. So the average level of happiness in Costa Rica is as high as it is in the United States. But the carbon impact of that society, the impact on the climate is much, much less. My guess is it's probably a tenth the amount that it is in the United States. Or the country of Bhutan, where the average GDP is $200 a year. The average general level of happiness in that country is really, really high because people have strong social bonds.
I also want to tag on to something you said a paragraph or two back, which is about the ways in which capitalism is not efficient. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about how it's not efficient on the starting side when somebody else pays for the research, that is the public. It's not efficient in the doing side if you're an industry like the fossil fuel industry, which gets subsidies along the way, which you could put straight into your profit side of your balance sheet if you chose to show it that way.
Yeah,
as a giveaway.
Yeah.
And then at the tail end, and this brings us back to climate, mm-hmm. when the mess is left behind, who pays for the cleanup?
That's right, and that's the concept they use in environmental economics that I really like, which is externalities. You know, the sort of like, if you're kind of, you know, saying like, you know, what are the costs and benefits of a situation? There are all kinds of things that if you're a smart capitalist or a lucky capitalist, you don't have to pay for. And that's, and garbage is one. Sort of, you know, think of climate as garbage. So if you can make it so that you can dump a bunch of waste and not have to be responsible for it, then you've externalized the cost of that. But that's at a cost to the commons. It's a cost to everybody else. So yeah, that's extremely inefficient. So if you were to ask, and people talk about that with agriculture, you know, by the way, where organic agriculture is much more efficient than agribusiness. Now, people think that agribusiness is more efficient because it's more profitable, but profitable and efficient are two really different concepts that get mixed up. So if you think about the amount of subsidies that go into the oil, if you think about the waste that's generated, and things like that, it's very, very inefficient. It's very inefficient. And if you think about the fact that organic agriculture kind of creates kind of a deep, livable fabric within a community and kind of forms of relationships among the people who work on organic farms, you can see that it creates a fabric of a good life. And I think that's a good thing. And so the concept of efficiency is just, it's a really slippery, nasty concept.
So we've sort of done this sketch of how capitalism got going. Mm-hmm. But I really want to go back. You use the metaphor of fabric. Uh-huh. That capitalism is not this monolith that we have to overthrow and probably can't, or if we do, we're going to end up with another totalitarian regime. Talk about how things are woven together, and both that we can pull out the bad strands and weave in the new ones.
I want to start by saying that feminist theory and anti-racist theory were super important for this book. And the reason they're important is because you know, traditional Marxist theory, as you just alluded to, kind of has this idea of capitalism as a system, almost like a machine, that you need to either throw away and start all over again, or, you know, well, that's what you're supposed to do with it, right? You're supposed to sort of overthrow the system. And, you know, early in the 20th century, people thought that was possible, and then it was clear that it wasn't possible, and then people became very pessimistic. Well, one of the things that I learned from feminist theory was, you know, if you're a feminist, you don't say, I have to overthrow the patriarchy or everything I do is kind of pointless and reformist and not really all that significant. What I say is, here are a bunch of practices that are problematic. Let me use my theory to understand with some depth what's problematic about those practices and what's causing them. And then you challenge them, right? And so that's how feminism has moved forward. And so that whole sort of metaphor of society as a fabric really comes from feminist theory. And specifically, I sort of took it from J.K. Gibson Graham, who is a composite author of two women who do fabulous work in anti-capitalism, but coming out of a feminist background. Then the piece from anti-racism is just that Michael Omi and Howard Wynant, they wrote a really great book called Racial Formation in the United States. And in that book, they talk about race as something that kind of builds up over time and becomes a system through the sort of like the settling of a bunch of practices that happen over time. And I use that as the sort of foundation for my theory in the book for how capitalism kind of reproduces itself. It's not a system like it's a sort of a totalistic machine, but rather it's a set of practices that people make happen. And what are the mechanisms that make that happen, and what are the things you can do to kind of disrupt that? And so that's the kind of theoretical core of the book, really takes its most basic premises from feminism and anti-racism. And I think the other place maybe where you wanted to go with that question is just that capitalism is not a thing that happens to white men, right, or just to white men. Capitalism is a set of practices that wrap us all up and in different ways. And one of the things I say kind of late in the book is that that there are ways that if you look at the feminist movement, I think that women have made tremendous gains in most of the areas you can make progress in without challenging capitalism. And then the areas where you're up against capitalism, it hasn't made such big gains. And the two biggest ones I would say where we haven't made many gains in feminism are the kind of work-life balance stuff, right, that everybody's working too many hours and having to sort of pay for the kinds of things that used to be part of kind of a happy home life. And so that's a place where, you know, until we can get work time reduction. So one of the big things I call for in the book as an anti-capitalist strategy is to try to push for us all working fewer hours. You know, people fought really hard, 100 years ago for the 8-hour day. And in France, they've got a 35-hour work week. And I think in this country, it's totally realistic for us to say, you've got a problem of people don't have enough time, there's not enough jobs for everybody, too much economic throughput in terms of, you know, the climate. If we were all to work 20-hour weeks, we would all be a lot happier, right? We would have a less capitalist lives, and we would have less kind of a gender problem there. So that's the one of the biggest places we haven't made gains for women in this country is work-life balance stuff.
And that would help men, too, if they got to work 20-hour weeks.
Well, yeah, it would help everybody. That's right. But it's a sort of a gendered history to what's happened there. Then the other place where I think we haven't made much progress has to do with kind of the commodification of women's bodies, right? And so that's another place where we're sort of up against kind of the capitalist machine.
We're talking with Cynthia Kaufman today. She's the author of Ideas for Action, which is coming out in the second edition this fall from PM Press, as well as Getting Past Capitalism, which is published by Lexington Books. Cynthia teaches at De Anza College in Cupertino. She's the director of the Institute for Community and Civic Engagement.
I think the question about sort of, you know, violence against women, that kind of, you know, all the sort of rape on campus stuff, that doesn't totally fit into my analysis, but I think part of what's happening is that's part of a backlash, right, about sort of the idea that, you know, sort of men not now knowing kind of where is their place in relationship to women, and being frustrated and feeling displaced because the economy is so bad and things like that, and sort of displacing a lot of that anger onto women. So I don't think you can explain all of what's left over with our gender struggles having to do with capitalism, but I think that capitalism is a big part of what's left. You know, whereas we made huge strides in sort of women's legal rights, in women's access to jobs and prestige and access to academia, we've made huge progress in those areas. And labor economists say that a big part of what's left with the wage gap in this country between men and women has to do with parenting. It's not just sort of prejudice against women or sort of they're not advocating enough for wages and things like that. It's really that when you leave work to have children, it's hard to come back at the same level. And things that have to do with women's primarily responsibility for childcare.
And there are also times when we find out, because it's in the corporate world, it's taboo. You're not allowed to talk about how much you make.
Right, right.
But occasionally, like with the Sony breach, we found out that at the executive level, that executive women in the same position as men were getting paid $1 million less a year.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, so I'm not saying that there isn't still that kind of wage gap. It's just, it's still a really serious problem. And I would say with regard to racism, too, that we have made serious good progress on kind of civil and legal rights, though that's not so true with respect to incarceration. And actually that's a whole, there's a really interesting analysis. I think Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, is by far the most important book for everybody to read about what we're dealing with race right now. And what that says is that it was actually, I mean, it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but I also think that it's true, a very particular Republican political strategy to freak white voters out about black people, and in order to get them to vote for Republicans. And so then millions of people have been put in jail for no good reason kind of for that. I mean, I think it's really simple, and it takes a lot of explanation to make that sound credible, but she does make that credible in her book. I think it's a very powerful, powerful analysis. And I'm not so sure you can't sort of tag that to capitalism. I think it's a sort of a separate issue. But what I would say is that, except for that, which is really huge, there have been real gains made by people of color, you know, since the civil rights movement. And yet, when you get to issues of farm labor, the still super exploitation of farm labor, or the lack of investment in communities of color, then you're dealing with capitalism. You're dealing with the fact that if you want money just to go wherever money feels like going, it's not necessarily going to go to low-income communities of color. So if you had a government that was working more strategically and intentionally trying to solve social problems, we wouldn't have the problems of poverty in communities of color that we have now. So it is related to capitalism.
Yeah, and I want to delve a little deeper into that, because I think you do in your books, and there's so many good authors lately, John A. Powell, Greg Grandin, writing about how race was constructed, and Michelle Alexander, how slavery transmogrified into Jim Crow, and then this new thing that she calls the new Jim Crow, mm-hmm. and, you know, we call the carceral state, that I would like to throw out there that our capitalism has always had black labor and black bodies under its control in various forms, as one of the means of making profit, and they have never been able to let go of that.
Yeah.
Just as women's labor has always been there in this mystified, not socially recognized, not paid role to reproduce the labor force, to use an old Marxist language.
Yeah.
And so that those things, the racism, the sexism, are structural. They're built in, and they're part of the subsidy that makes capitalism profitable.
Yeah, no, that's right. And yet, I think a danger of the direction you're going is to sort of, is again, sort of seeing it as the whole system, right? And so I agree with what you're saying, and I want to just step back just a tiny bit and say that there's a history there, there's a trajectory there. It also doesn't mean that can't change, though, either, right? You know, in other words, because sometimes Marxists will take that in the direction of saying, so therefore it is a sort of a system that is racist and sexist in its core, and you're not going to solve the problem of racism or sexism until you overthrow capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's where I don't want to go,
right?
But what I want to say is, yes, there's a history there, and definitely the history of racism is completely tied up with the history of capitalism. And I talk about that a lot in the book, and Omi and Wynant talk about it as well in their book. And the point there is that the extreme wealth that got the Industrial Revolution started would not have happened without slavery and colonialism, you know, and that was just a core part of that original accumulation that got capitalism going and was built deeply into the structure.
I just want to remind our listeners we're talking with Cynthia Kaufman, who's the author, among other things, of Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change, and her latest book, Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope. And I want to build on the point you just made, that talking about how racism and patriarchy are embedded and intrinsic, I think, to the form of capitalism we have. For me, I don't take it in the direction of saying, oh, well, we can't deal with those issues until we overthrow this system, which is really the core, the structure, and everything else is kind of a plug-in add-on.
Mm-hmm.
What I actually think, where it has brought me lately, is that because capitalism actually relies on so much exploitation and so many forms of subsidy and violence, including war, to take back territories and control over resources, all the time.
Yeah.
Like the last 14 years of continuous war that still haven't ended since the United States, you know, reinvaded Iraq and went after Afghanistan and now God knows where, plus all the covert wars.
Right.
That actually, my conclusion is, capitalism's really expensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's actually a huge amount of resources available on the planet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We can feed 9 billion people.
Well, totally. Yeah, no, and that, I think that capitalism has this concept of efficiency, but also has this weird concept of scarcity. Like, there isn't enough, right? And there isn't enough to go around, so we're all going to have to fight over it. And, Amartya Sen work is really powerful in that, where he has argued that there's never been a famine in this world where the country that had the famine didn't have enough food in that country. In other words, the problem was never that there wasn't enough food. The problem is always politics and usually money. Mike Davis also has a really good book called Late Victorian Holocausts that's all about these famines that were caused by capitalism and the millions of people who died. Because we often talk about the famines that were caused by Maoism or by the Soviet state or whatever, which are, you know, serious, real terrible things. I'm not trying to minimize that at all. But Mike Davis's book talks about all of the famines that happened because of colonialism and capitalism, where people by the millions died because they didn't have the money to get the food that existed within their nation. So absolutely. And still to this day, we're subsidizing the oil companies in this country to the tune of billions of dollars. I mean, how crazy is that?
And they are now the most profitable industries on earth.
Right.
And they are making record profits within their own most profitable industries.
Yeah.
And we're paying for it.
Exactly. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And things like the Deepwater Horizon, it's like, probably listeners to this show know that, and Bill McKibben's been talking about it, I think it's such a great point, is that 80% of the reserves that the oil companies have on their books listed as assets already discovered, already under their control, have to stay in the ground for us to survive the climate crisis, which means there really should not be any new exploration. So the idea that we're subsidizing oil companies in order to do exploration is just astonishing. And, you know, and the disasters like the Deepwater Horizon are happening because they're looking for oil in more and more obscure places because they want even more assets on their books. I mean, it's really, really ludicrous.
So speaking of the way forward, let's get the takeaways from your book on how we deal with capitalism.
The similar reasoning to what I just said about the climate, I think about capitalism, that most people don't want to talk about capitalism because it's totally negative and overwhelming. So I think that the way you fight against capitalism, I have a sort of 10 different things in the book, but let me just take a couple of them. One of them is to start talking about it, because we've all been afraid to name it, because that means you're some kind of a weird communist or, you know, whatever. People have all these strange ideas about what it means to be anti-capitalist. We have to start talking about capitalism, and fighting for things like shorter work hours, I think, is really, really important. Fighting against things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So one of the ways that I think that capitalism reproduces itself is by transnational agreements like the World Trade Organization, Trans-Pacific Partnership. So you just have to kind of figure out what are each of those things that make capitalism function, and you fight against them, right? You fight against the power that corporations have over our political system. You fight for more democracy. So my point is that it's a bunch of things like that. That's all the taking down negative stuff. Then there's the other part, which is building a new world, because the other thing I argue is that most of our economy, even in the United States, is not capitalist. More than half of it is a household economy, gift-based economy. We also have worker-owned cooperatives. We have lots of non-capitalist things in our world right now.
And the government.
All those things function better than capitalism. We're happier in them. We need more of them. So the idea is to take down the old and to build up the new, and that's my strategy.
So as we move to wrap up, I want to hear from you, because you're a professor at a community college. Mm-hmm. Your book talks about the vanguardism of the old left, you know, that being replaced with a sort of anti-oppression and empowerment type of politics. But I feel like even that is kind of your and my generation. I want to know, what models, what are you hearing from young people? What do your students talk about? What are their issues? How do they organize? What are they thinking?
Yeah.
What do they come in knowing?
I feel really lucky that that my teaching now is in a community organizing training program, and I'm part of a national network of programs like that, so I have a sense of that world. You know, I think that most of the people that I work with, they're very concerned about racism, you know, and especially this stuff about police violence is really powerful, and I think it's going to hopefully take on and get some traction and make a difference. Very concerned about inequality. I think Occupy was huge. Immigration rights, I think, are really important. A lot of my students are undocumented, and a lot of them are concerned about the issues of the undocumented. I think a lot of them are actually wondering right now. I have to say that I have a sense of, we've been sort of coasting on some older paradigms, and that there's not a huge amount of attention to the bigger questions of how do we organize. It's interesting, you know, I've been teaching for years, one of the sections in my class, I do a little thing between the contrast of prefigurative politics, which is that idea that comes out of feminism, of you make the road by walking, and that the process matters as much as the product, and it's really important for everybody to be involved. And I contrast that to vanguardism, which, you know, the idea of a kind of a small group have really thought it through and have it all figured out, you know.
And the rest of you just follow orders.
But what I wanted to say is that I've always been sort of inclined towards prefigurative politics and critical of vanguardism. And this term, the first time I had a bunch of students arguing for vanguardism, and I realized that they are feeling the need for more focus, strategy. And so, right, there's all the negative things about vanguardism, like you people sit back and be quiet and just do what you're told. But there's the other part of, no, let's actually, so here's the good part of vanguardism, okay? Where people really analyze the situation, where they really strategize, where they really sit down and figure out what they're trying to accomplish and how they're going to accomplish it. It's not just, let's make sure that the politics is all always fun and rewarding, but let's actually sometimes maybe have it be that we have to go through some really terrible, boring meetings where we figure out what the hell we're trying to do before we actually jump in and do it, right? I'm seeing more of that in my students, which I actually think is really healthy.
They want it.
They want it. They want to sit back. They want to reflect. They want to strategize more than I've seen in previous years, and I'm very excited about that.
Well, I think your two books are a fabulous contribution because they give people a historical context and a conceptual context. And it sort of brings people not only through 500 years of capitalist history, but also brings people through the last few decades and maybe even the whole last century of activism,
right,
and how it has evolved and sort of where we're going. So I want to encourage our listeners to take a look at Cynthia Kaufman's books, Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change, the second edition of which is coming out in fall 2015 from PM Press, and Getting Past Capitalism, History, Vision, Hope, which is already available from Lexington Books. Cynthia Kaufman teaches at the Institute for Community and Civic Engagement at De Anza College, and she teaches community organizing and philosophy. So Cynthia Kaufman, thank you very much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you.
So that's it for this week's edition of Post Carbon Radio. Thanks for listening. You can listen to all our archived Post Carbon Radio programs at wmpostcarbon.com.